The baby making years are hard. I'm Dr. Sterling, and I'm here to help. Welcome to the Ask Dr. Sterling podcast.
This content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or qualified health provider with any medical questions you may have.
Welcome back to the Ask Dr. Sterling podcast, and we are so excited to be joined by Erica Jossa, who is a registered psychotherapist specializing in maternal mental health. But not only that, you might have seen her online as the CEO and founder of MomWell. But this is going to be a personal episode for her as well, because she is a mom to three boys and has personally shared her dealing with postpartum depression and is why she now advocates for accessible maternal mental health care and really redefining expectations for motherhood. So thank you, Erica, for being here with us.
Thank you both for having me. I'm so excited we finally made our paths align. And
yes,
it's, you know, it's rough with all these children and sicknesses and businesses and things, but we're here and I'm so excited.
And I've wanted to speak with you ever since I got a copy of your book, Releasing the Mother Load. When did this come out, by the way? Because I feel like
April 2024. So it's okay. Not quite a year yet. Still a baby book.
Okay. Yeah. I can't think of another. This is a book that really practically goes through the invisible load of parenthood and taking care of children and provides practical strategies for actually navigating that load with your partner. And I really can't think of another book that has done this. And So ever since I read your book, I've wanted to chat with you. And I'm glad that we're finally here almost a year after it was released.
I know. No, we're making it work. I'm so excited. Thank you. And I think that one of the things we don't realize is how early and how sort of sneakily this invisible load begins for us. Mm-hmm. And I might surprise some of you listening as we really start to unpack it. Like the seeds are planted for this early, early on. It's not, you know, the house is on fire and burning down when we're, you know, melting down about it, maybe postpartum or with a toddler and we're at our wit's end, but it begins early, early on.
You know, there's so much responsibility on us as women to control our fertility and to not get pregnant when we don't want to get pregnant and to get pregnant when we do. And even just like the decision of, okay, what type of birth control am I going to be on? Having to try different types of birth control to find what works for you, the procedures that you may have to undergo to control, you know, to prevent pregnancy when you don't want it. Mm-hmm. And then deciding when you're ready. It starts before you're even trying to have a family. It starts when you're not trying to have a family.
Yeah. If we really want to, I feel like the therapist in the room always does this. If we want to really take it like real back.
Let's roll it back.
Take it real back. I love that.
It really starts when we are being conditioned into our gender roles early on. And gender was never in my like vocabulary and like frame of reference at all as a therapist or as a person. Like I didn't really think of it very much until I started to dive into to try to understand what are the origins of this load? Where do they begin? And what is perpetuating it to constantly be handed to mothers? Like, what is going on here? And the more that I explored it, the more I began to see that a lot of like societal messaging and a lot of even like the faith upbringing that I had or different community beliefs very early on have all the girls and aunties and grandmas in the kitchen cooking, you know, holiday dinner while partners are wherever. So if we really take it real back, we are conditioned to try to step into this role in all perfection and try to carry it as best we can. And that messaging we've seen and ingested for years before we're even in that place, that time in life.
And the interesting thing too is, I mean, there's clearly differences between the sexes, you know, obviously there's differences. And it's that I think it's so interesting, the interplay between like our biology, our genetics, what is biologically different about us, what is genetically different about us, and then how kind of the phenotype of those genetic and biological differences shows up in our societies and cultures, and trying to tease out, well, I can just see so clearly with my daughter and with my sons, with myself and my husband, with myself and my brothers, there's differences between us and how much it's the nurture versus nature thing, you know?
Totally.
I think it's too messy to really separate out. We have to kind of accept, okay, this is what it is. And let's try to make the best so that we don't have this incredible mental load that is just so one-sided, because it's obviously we're still at a place where even people, you know, women who work outside of the home are doing the majority of the work at home. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
well, when we when we unpack the tasks and the things that we're talking about, like concretely, we're talking about, let's say, tracking ovulation or reaching out to fertility specialists, or we're talking about when we're pregnant, how we're coming up with our birth plan. But beyond that, even our postpartum adjustment plan and our mental health plan and stuff like that. These are like tasks that are essential, things that need to be done while we are trying to conceive, while we are pregnant. But none of these tasks are actually gendered. So in the opening chapter of the book I go through, it's building on a concept that I got from Kate Mangino's book, Equal Partners, where she went through just male and female and what do we think and associate. And I go more into like the parental roles, like mom versus dad, and what do we think is aligned that way. And we have very compartmentalized sort of shelves where we would put mom tasks and dad tasks. But why? Why are we putting it on that shelf? Because it's been modeled for us. That's what we're taught. Changing a diaper does not have a gender associated to it. Very few things do. Like if we're breastfeeding, but then even then my partner would wake with the baby, bring the baby into me to feed, take baby back, change, burp, settle. So he even still was very much a part of that process. Yes. Or delivering. But beyond that, these tasks and this load that we're talking about are by and large defaulted to mom. Yeah. But we have to unlearn and rethink sort of with a curious eye, why? Why were they in my invisible backpack kind of dumped in there? Why am I carrying them? And can this be shared? And it's surprising when you start to unpack it, like, wait. This was auto-assigned to me.
Yeah, I didn't auto-assigned to this. Second.
Like, unsubscribe me from this load, please. I do not.
I do want to add, we've had so many events inside the Sterling Parents membership where same-sex couples or non-binary people join and have said that they've had the same experience with whoever is the birthing person. The person carrying the baby is automatically assigned all of these roles that they have to take. And even if it is a woman, it's the non-birthing partner that for some reason is given a break on a lot of this. And it was interesting to hear because seems to fall on one parent more than the other from the start.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes that's proximity, right? Like sometimes that is, okay, like in early in my initial maternity leaves, and I'm Toronto-based, so I took 12 months with each of my boys postpartum, which I know is, you know.
It's like a fairy tale.
I have a primarily U.S. audience, which I know is like a privilege to have.
Yeah.
And in doing that, it's like, okay, my husband made more income than I did. Mm-hmm. And like we go through the logistics and, okay, I'm going to be the one that stays home and does this. And so sometimes it's proximity, and with proximity becomes experience. And this is where it starts to snowball.
Yes.
Is a lot of parents who stay home, who gain that sort of expert level knowledge because they're in the role day in and day out.
Yes.
Sort of often auto, like assume that it will auto redistribute when they reintegrate back into the workplace if they do. And it doesn't. Yeah. Like 95% of the time. And so we start to kind of like assemble this, like unintentionally, not ourselves, but like we start to build this sort of cage around us where now I'm so entrenched in the maternal knowledge that I carry. I don't know how to get you up to speed at a level where you're going to handle this in a way that I feel comfortable with it being handled. And so there are many layers to even just the sharing of knowledge and preferences and knowing of the soothing and the fussy baby and all of that. So there's a lot here to unpack, but it's possible. It's possible to do as like an awareness, and making this invisible load visible is the first step to us actually intervening in these default patterns.
Those of us, oftentimes it's the women in the relationship who carry the children, birth the children, feed the children, we end up with being the primary parent, being the bearer of a lot of this invisible load. In some ways, we're kind of like, we're the the most obviously injured party that's like, hey, we need to share some of this. What I will say is, one, that unequal distribution has such negative impact on the relationship between the father and the children, and or the other parent who's not the primary parent and the children. Because when my husband and I have had moments in time in which I was very much had more of the load and was doing more of the child rearing, there was a sadness to it for him because the kids would come to me. And he really, really didn't like that. I would love to see more dads just having this conversation and it not be so much coming from us being like, hey,
yeah,
we're drowning over here.
It's interesting because I saw my partner kick into his sort of socialized, you know, norms and expectations of I need to provide. Like I need to hustle. I need to get a promotion. I have, you know, kids to take care of. Which meant him having to do some like licensing exams. He's in finance and a bunch of different things, which actually made him very inaccessible to me in a time where I was most vulnerable and needed him the most.
Yeah.
So I actually just had somebody on my podcast, Paul Sullivan. He runs the Company of Dads, where he's challenging the idea of what it means to be a provider and really becoming curious about what that word means now in the era of parenting that we're in.
Yeah.
Because while, yes, we do need to provide for our family and there's a lot of financial instability and things going on right now, that's very painful for people. But then also I need you to be an emotional sort of safe place for me too, and like a provider in that sense. And so when we recognize that these norms are there and we become curious about them and challenge them, there might be things that fit that we want to hold on to.
Yeah.
But then there might be things that feel like they are trapping us and keeping us from being, you know, in the parent that we want to be. Like my husband did not want to be 12 hours a day downtown Toronto away from the family of young infant kids at home, right? Like, but he had to provide for the family. And also, you know, like we have unpacked a lot and now he's more the default parent and does pick up and drop off and does dinner. And it took some time, but it wasn't until I had my own, I call it breakdown turn breakthrough, where I really fell apart on my third postpartum to realize this is unsustainable and I'm going to burn myself into the ground trying to do all of this myself. And that unlocked things to be reevaluated for us and sort of put under the microscope, which started this whole amazing journey, much of which is documented in the book, of how now almost in completely reverse roles, but it's also very fluid and we go back and forth with those responsibilities.
We have a somewhat similar situation to y'all because my husband makes more than I do and has since we graduated from residency. He's an emergency physician. And, you know, when I was pregnant and having to work, I was the one who had to cut back on my hours and go to like part-time, which was 40 hours a week, go to part-time. And part of the reason why I left and started my company and left clinical practice was obviously the problems that I saw in the world with prenatal and postpartum care, but also just the logistics of like trying to go through another difficult pregnancy, doing 24-hour shifts and doing this kind of really, really intense labor. And so my job became the more flexible one. But if you actually look at us and our personalities, I'm the one who wants to work and be out in the world and work full time and literally cannot imagine ever not working. I probably work until the day I die. And my husband would much rather be at home. He wants to be a stay-at-home dad. He's super fulfilled with that. We're doing that transition where we're hopefully going to get our actual roles out in the world to line up with our personalities. But it's just interesting that your personality and your gender roles don't always match up.
Exactly. I'm very much the same as you in that like A-type, like my husband taking on the load that he did after we started to work through and sort of piece myself back together allowed me the space to found a freaking entire company, you know, which never would have happened if my time was already spoken for in all of the invisible labor and care tasks.
Yeah.
And so what we're talking about here is so much bigger than just the tasks themselves and the keeping score and the tit for tat. We're talking about having autonomy over decision-making and how we spend our time.
Yeah.
And what I'm hearing so much from those in my community is like, I don't even have time to like take care of myself and feed myself, let alone like dream outside of my role of motherhood.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And there can be a lot of envy. Like I would watch my husband put on his suit each day and go and further his career. And I'm here covered in spit up and cracked nipples and all the rest of it. Like I used to be somebody outside of this role.
That identity piece is so big because, you know, you talk about provider, looking at the gender roles is so crucial because the idea that I personally would be the one who is financially responsible for my family is not something that I have seen modeled for me in my family. My personality very much wants to be the provider, but I have to decondition from this. Meanwhile, my husband, you know, his mom was the provider and was, I don't want to have all of the provider responsibility on me.
And this is the part that makes it so tricky because like, okay, we think about the window of expression for gender. For women in 1950, only 25% of mothers worked outside of the home.
Yeah.
Fast forward to now, 86 or 87% of mothers, women working outside of the home. And so we have an array of, we can, I mean, it doesn't come without people's, you know, trolling, but we can be at home, we can work, we can blend the two, but our partners face their own load. And it might not be caretaking tasks, but being the provider of the home, if that is what they feel they have to take on and embody to be a good parent and, you know, comes with its own stress and anxiety. And their window is much more truncated than ours because for a partner to stay home is not as sort of accessible or acceptable to people. Like fewer dads at the park than moms, and we stay at home and there's this dynamic that's not as welcoming for dads. So there is more boundaries and restrictions sort of put on how they show up. So it's really important for us to acknowledge that we each have our own pressures and we each have our own load, because I find we go to resentment and we go to like being at odds and keeping score with one another instead of acknowledging that this isn't my partner's fault. This isn't my fault. We're actually tackling these like expectations societally or like gender wise. And we need to pair up as a team in order to do that, or else we're going to be at each other's throats and resenting and keeping score. Like we need the team pairing in it all. And if our partner is the problem in our mind, like what, how are we working as a team? And what solution is there to like a flawed human being? Like it starts to become pretty hopeless and powerless when we're trying to change somebody who doesn't want to change. Like, it creates a whole other set of patterns and norms, right?
Yeah.
So getting really clear about what the problem is that we're trying to solve here is really, really important.
Yeah.
I'm really curious, Erica, at what point in your reproductive journey since you've had three kids, was this clear that the mental load disparity was a problem? And was it evident to your partner as well, or was it something that you had to bring to the table?
I describe this in my book as my aha moment, where it became visible to me for the first time. And I had this laundry mountain, like curse a laundry mountain. Like how can it level such a like, you know, I'm like, we've got all these A-time moms, people talking about all the things they've accomplished, yet we will be taken down by a pile of freaking laundry. So this mountain was building up in my master bedroom. And I'm walking by it every day. Like, why can't you just fold the laundry and put it away? Like, what is wrong with you? It's just, it's such a simple task. And like family of five piled up for weeks. And every time such shame about it. It wasn't until either my husband got curious or I got curious about it. Like, what is it about folding it and putting it away that is so difficult? Like rather than moving into shame and self-criticism and self-blame and all of these things, telling myself how not good I am, that this is a reflection of my worth in my role.
Yeah.
Like, why is this hard? And I explained that, well, it's a changeover in season. So I have to fold all of this laundry. But before I can put it away, I have to rotate all the kids' dressers. Yeah. I have to then make a list for all the new seasonal items that we need. And I have to find a place to store the previous you know, items because the other boys will grow into them. And before I really knew it, there was like 4 to 6 hours of more physical labor and all kinds of mental labor involved in just making space for that folded laundry to be put away. Yeah. It had nothing to do with the folding of the laundry itself. And that was my first moment of like, oh, okay. Like, it's not the task that is necessarily the problem here. It's the like iceberg underneath the surface that facilitates this task to happen that I'm drowning in. And once my husband's very like process oriented. So when we kind of got a handle on that's what it was, like, it's very easy to come up with a solution when we have all the cards in front of us and we know what we're actually dealing with. Right. And that began many, like the first of many, many conversations about how we can parse apart and share that labor in a more effective way.
Yeah.
Looking back on it, have started some of the work that you did once the pile of laundry finally got there to, oh, when we started trying to conceive, I would have put this X, Y, and Z in place so that we were in a better spot years to come. Where do you go back and recommend people start?
It's interesting because I didn't have any kind of fertility or infertility journey. We were a year married and we're kind of like, if we try, we try. If we don't, we don't. Kind of just very nonchalant about it, which I know is not a lot of people's experience. So for my journey, I would have started in pregnancy. But what I hear a lot with clients that I work with is how absolutely isolating and grueling this is in the trying to conceive infertility period. We've got appointments. We've got blood work. We've got so many things. And I was actually reading in prep for our chat today that 1/3 of infertility is, you know, sort of deemed to be mom. 1/3 of it is deemed to be dad. And 1/3, I guess, is like they can't determine what the problem is.
Yeah.
So yes, it's related to our body, but it takes two human beings to facilitate a pregnancy.
Yeah.
And so these appointments and being involved, like you are literally a part of this equation and could potentially be, you know, going through the appointments to be like a part of the factor of like what's going on here. So I think that we just sort of auto assume, or it gets default handed to us, like with this invisible backpack that we carry, where I'm like, okay, now I need to shed myself of all the toxins and eat all the healthy food and lose all of the weight and do all of the things that I need to do in order to make this oven of mine acceptable and take on all the hypervigilance associated with that, when it actually might be our problem, that our partner that has a fertility problem.
Yeah.
So it's really like not auto adapting and taking on these things by default and questioning what can be shared in this process.
Yeah.
And how are we both going to be keepers of knowledge? I can't be the only keeper of knowledge. So it might not be financially, you know, responsible or appropriate to both be at every single fertility meeting.
Yeah.
But can they be dialed in every time they're in with the doctor so that both of us are on the same level of knowledge of this process and what the next steps are. So I don't have to own not only doing that, but also relaying it to you.
Yes.
I've had so many clients who in high risk pregnancies would be the one to go to the appointment and get devastating news.
And then
And then be burdened with the task of then having to go and tell their partner.
Like, there's a million questions, right?
And you're just like in shock and trying to process and maybe there's more tests and maybe there's like all these things going on. And so wherever we can set up systems and processes to share knowledge from the get-go so that no one person is the owner of this domain as it relates to children and parenthood, the better, because the more we own that knowledge, the harder it is to parse it apart and to share it. Possible, but just takes us more time.
Yeah. And I think the other thing too about the trying to conceive and the pregnancy journey and postpartum is this, of the support that we need is emotional support, right? If you have a male partner, you have someone historically not really been taught how to do any kind of emotional labor for other people, you know, as women, as people who were socialized as women and grew up as girls, we've been taking care of other people's feelings, like, you know, sometimes to our detriment our whole lives. So when you've got, a baby who you need to soothe, when you've got a toddler whose emotions are out of control. We've been doing this since we were babies. We were brand new parents. I said, Garrett, you have to also provide me with emotional support. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I'm going to be honest. Like, I don't really know what that is. Mm-hmm. And so he Googled it. He read these articles I found a note on his phone about when a step-by-step process to do when I was upset and how to provide emotional support to me, which was so tender and so cute. It can be really challenging. Sometimes we talk about weaponized incompetence. And I think that sometimes that's a very real thing with our male partners and weaponized incompetence. But sometimes they truly have not been given the same toolkit that we have. Mm-hmm. They're starting at kindergarten level of this is what emotions are. This is how you provide emotional support. And we're PhD level and we're there's this mismatch, you know?
Yeah.
And you actually talk about this in your book. You are the only one who knows what you need, and therefore it is up to you to advocate for yourself. We can't necessarily expect our partners to have the same emotional care toolkit as we do. Mm-hmm. And equate them anticipating our needs and knowing how to take care of us with that's what love is. Mm. And I think the reframe that really helped me personally, and I don't know if this will help anybody else, but I hope, was that for me, love is my husband's ability to be willing to try and learn, but he is not coming to our relationship with the same emotional toolkit.
Mm-hmm. That discrepancy can create so much friction, and clients will talk to me about feeling abandoned in the postpartum period or even pregnancy and birth, labor and under-supported. And that gap is so evident. We've been, we said, maybe even took the babysitter's course, have been around kids, been babysitting. We've been taught as women to center everyone else's needs before our own, to people please. This is something that's sort of been ingrained in us.
Yeah.
And so our partners, it's interesting though, because they have the skills, and it depends on the environment that they're in. If they are managing a team and they have to give a review, they're not going to coddle and be as, maybe diplomatic and tactful as we might navigate that situation, but they can navigate it, and they manage and they troubleshoot and they problem solve and they do all of these things often in other environments, but not to the standard way that we would do it. And I feel like I was really, this is my burden to bear in a lot of ways, because not only am I just mom and woman, I'm a therapist who lives and breathes emotions. So any emotional situation, I want to be no, that is mine to handle, And my partner and I have worked really hard at allowing me not jumping in and allowing the tension and the discomfort of him sort of bambying his way, through a situation in order to gain his own confidence and efficacy in his role. We gain confidence by doing, by failing, by correcting and along the way. And that's what makes us good in our role.
Yeah.
And that's really hard to allow space for, especially I think when we get into the postpartum period where it feels like all the fire alarms are going off and all of the things are happening and we are, navigating sleep deprivation and in crisis mode, for lack of a better word. It becomes hard to have to then shift into your partner's learning sort of in tandem. We're both learning to be parents, but they're learning in a way that comes easy and natural to us.
Yeah.
And so that can create frustration. And I do a lot of postpartum planning with parents and couples. We have guides and different plans that they can download at MomWell, but also so many on-ramps to therapy in our practice are people who are preparing for a second or third baby because the first one was so jarring that they want to be better prepared.
Yes.
And so there are ways to get ahead of some of these things and be really clear. I actually have a needs list carved out. What resource is it now? I don't know. Don't quote me. I think it's our postpartum rage course that I do with Psyched Mummy, where it's like a checklist of when I'm feeling this way, here are the things that will help. It's kind of what your partner Googled, but a little bit more personalized.
Yeah.
And we check off, and you'll know that this is working by seeing that I'm this, this, and this. And just allows conversations and preparation for some of those things before before we are in the 11th hour and ready to lose our minds because we haven't slept for 2 or 3 days, right?
Yes.
So conversations and prep for this ahead of time, again, seeing that load ahead of time, it's kind of like identifying the iceberg that is ahead and saying, whoa, how are we going to correct or prepare? Yep. Even if we do make some impact, how are we going to lessen how that will affect us as a couple and as a family, and what can we do to get ahead of it? Yeah. And so much of these conversations and the prepping for the postpartum period is a big piece.
Yeah, so important.
I'm so curious, Erica, as a mom to three boys, has this influenced your parenting at all, knowing what we've talked about gender roles and kind of them not having necessarily a toolkit the way they were raised? Is this making you take some inventory on how you do it in your household?
Yeah, it's interesting. I always joke that one of the things that I want to instill in my boys is that there is no one default person in this house responsible for anything, right? Yeah. And so it's so funny because I'll like just kind of for my own checkpoint quiz the kids, like, you know, who usually does this? Who usually does that? Or just kind of like ask them. And like daddy is only like 60 to 70% of most things these days. And again, like I probably need to make some space to bring that more to equal or fair, but that they won't auto assume. They won't look to the woman or the mom in the room when someone says, I'm hungry, I need a snack.
Yeah.
Or when, you know, something needs to be planned for school or school cash online needs lunch money or like whatever. And I think that we're really achieving that. And another piece is that emotional awareness and intelligence. Such a small example, but something that was so meaningful to me is like parenting and child relationships are not reciprocal, right? Yeah. For the longest time, they're not reciprocal.
Yeah.
And I always tell the kids I love them, tuck them in. And it's always like, you know, mommy loves you when you're happy, when you're mad, when whatever decisions you make, all of that. And just recently with my 9-year-old, I'm like, so when mommy says I love you, like it'd be nice for you to say, I love you too, mom. Like usually when people say I love you, like you reciprocate back and say, I love you too. And that feels really good to feel like, you know, and just teaching him some of these emotional cues and awareness. Yeah. So that was actually just like a week ago. And so he'll come in and he'll be like, I love you, mom. And he'll even say it first now. And he knows that it's just one of those things. But it's simple, but it's also impactful because you want to teach them how to have reciprocal friendships, not to center themselves when they walk into a room and to think about the other people who are there and at play. So those are small little examples, but they feel very meaningful to me when they happen.
I feel like these boys are going to be such a gift to have a parent, whether it's mom or dad, who can teach them to navigate the emotions of life. And I think that's huge. And, you know, all of us out here are just trying to learn enough so that we can instill that knowledge in our kids. You know, I think that's one thing that you can't really understand until you're a parent. And once your kids are a little bit older, like out of baby and into toddler and school age kids, when you go through a day, you have to handle your own emotions, but also you really do have to be a container of these emotions of your children. There's a huge weight to kind of managing other people, sometimes very unreasonable people.
Well, this is one of the biggest crosses to bear, I think, in our era of parenting. This is what I hear from my community all the time. We are learning while on the job. Yes. We are trying to learn how to regulate our own emotions and account for the skills that we have not been taught while also trying to model them for our children in tandem at the same time. And that is wild. Like that is, it's a lot of pressure. Yes. We are not going to get it right a lot of the time. And even if we were perfect at it, we're human and we're still going to mess up. Like no parent is perfectly calm all the time. Like we are human. But that is one of the biggest pressures. Like, I don't want to screw up my child. I don't want to cause them, you know, trauma and harm. But also I wasn't taught these skills. So like, how do I learn and set them up for, like, you know, healthy emotions or healthy relationships. And we're all just doing our best out here, trying to do it for ourselves and also do it for them.
I mean, that's almost a full-time job, and that's just on top of all of the other.
I know, that's not even, that's more like the emotional load versus even this mental load, yeah, right? Like, it's exactly. I mean, they overlap and they're very similar, but yeah, it's a lot.
It's so much, but it sounds like you are pumping out resources that we all need to make it a little bit easier for everyone. So can you tell us a little bit more about where people can access this amazing stuff that you're putting out?
Yeah. So in the book, I go through from the trying to conceive to while pregnant in the postpartum, like map out all of those loads. I call them load maps. And I try to make all of that labor visible for you. If you don't have the book, I would encourage you to get it. I also do have these load maps as a free download at my website, ericajossa.com. So if you're just interested in the load maps, you can get those there and make this visible for yourselves. Yeah. That is the first step. We're not going to conquer this in a night, but we can at least begin to become aware. And that is the biggest and first step that we need to take. So we have that. I have that at my website. And then I also have a team of specialized perinatal mental health therapists that are coast to coast in the U.S. We're in over 15 states. We are in network in California, New York, Texas, Florida, Michigan, Tennessee, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and others. And our therapists are trained in the adjustment to motherhood, the mental load, understanding the nuances of mom rage, understanding intrusive thoughts. It's a very safe and non-judgmental environment where you can bring your scary, disturbing thoughts and adjustment to motherhood and not be reported on and not be judged and not carry all this fear coming into it. And that's a major – being in network has made it so accessible for parents, like $0 to $15 on average co-pays to really get that support or to prepare even for the next baby to come or whatever that looks like, process birth trauma, all of those things. And beyond that, we've got the Mom Well podcast that talks about all kinds of these topics. Social media on Instagram, come hang out. There's something every day there for you. We're just a hub of all the resources, but there's something for everybody, at Mom Well.
Yeah, I definitely want to echo getting the book, releasing the mother load. There's one other line that I wanted to make sure we slipped in here to this episode because it was a big aha for me when I read it. You don't exist to take care of your house. It is meant to serve you. That whole idea of, I have to clean the house. Man, when I read that, I was like, oh yeah, this is here to serve me. I'm not. I think it's a really important perspective. And there's a lot of different perspectives and really, really practical advice that you provide in this book. So thank you for writing it. I am writing my own book, so I know I know how intense the book writing process is. So thank you for putting your heart and soul into this incredible book.
Thank you so much. I think that it's really amazing for like your platform and for us as professionals to pull back the veil and be transparent in our journeys. And I weave a lot of that in there because hey, like we're all supporting each other in this community and trying to figure it out. And if I learned tools and if I learned to unload and release some of this, so can you, because that's definitely not where I started. Yeah. So there's definitely lots of hope and ways to change moving forward. And I appreciate you having me here.
Yeah, thank you for being here, Erica.
Thanks for listening to Ask Dr. Sterling. Is there someone in your life who would benefit from listening to this episode? Send it to them. If you've left a review in Apple Podcasts or Spotify, thank you so much. Please send me a DM at Ask Dr. Sterling Podcast on Instagram with a screenshot so I can say thank you personally.